And my bookmark is showing page 900. So I believe that's the paragraph starting with the first condition of the soul's complete emergence.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I'm showing that also.
So there was the, perhaps you could summarize the previous paragraph before we start reading.
Yeah, okay. So here Sri Aurobindo is bringing us into the consideration of the psychic being as the inmost being in man, the true person. And he brings that about by showing the complexity of the psychology and the difficulty of extracting, as it were, the soul influence from the mixed action of a variety of things that are going on in us. Partly we are receiving influences from a variety of sources, from universal nature, and from activities pertaining to the inner being of man. So all these variety of activities are presenting themselves to the surface nature where a mixed working is going on. So Sri Aurobindo has dealt with this in great detail in the previous paragraphs. Then he comes up with this notion that if we are to think of what is the soul, there are a few ways by which we can approach it. One of them is to look for that in us which persists beyond the death of the body, that which is continuous in us. And also that which is the gives us the sense of self. So here, in dealing with that, he points to the complexity in that idea as well, that it is easy for us to jump to certain conclusions based on our own state of consciousness, that a subtle physical reality may be taken to be that self or that persistent self in us, or else a vital reality may be taken to be the same and has been taken by several cultures. And in individual cases, it is very difficult to make a difference between these because of the unorganized aspect of the inner life. So he comes to where we are right now with a paragraph in which he brings out the fact, or two paragraphs before this where he brings out the fact that apart from this confusion on the surface, even if you were to look for a self within, we are liable to mistake one of three forms of self to be the true self. That the psychic being has, as it were, in front of it, three beings which are distinct and which in a way are their own person. These are the physical being of physical Purusha, vital being of vital Purusha, and mental being of mental Purusha. Now, were these beings not to be present, we would have had a psychic being, even if it was deep within, and an action of cosmic nature in us. But as a matter of fact, the sense of self is present in our ordinary beings, not only as ego on the surface, but under the surface in each of these three forms, organizing the cosmic prakriti of the physical consciousness, the vital consciousness, and the mental consciousness into some semblance of personal action. We think of ourselves as the thinker. We think of ourselves as the doer. We think of ourselves as the person with feelings. We think of ourselves as the person who acts with the physical body. Because each of these has a sense of self due to the presence of a Purusha at these levels. There is a true self at each of these levels, as it were. And this is what brings Sri Aurobindo in the previous paragraphs into the discussion of what he calls the central self. So I believe I'm remembering that last time we had also taken up the discussion of Swabhava and Swadharma. based on this notion of the Purusha of the three levels. Ultimately, the central self and the origin of Swabhava and Swadharma is the psychic being. But in any individual, in any particular life, that psychic being is deeply hidden and acts more predominantly through one of these Purushas, which therefore takes on the aspect of the central being in that person. So if the mental Purusha is the central being, then the mental activities predominate. Naturally, it is the organization of the mental prakriti that becomes the work of that particular lifetime. So too, if the vital Purusha predominates, then it is the vital life which gets predominance and also some amount of organization. So too, similarly, the physical life. Now, in this previous paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is moving from there to consider spiritual aspect of this particular phenomenon. That even in this substitute centrality of one of these Purushas or persons, what we find is that there is an influence of the psychic being or of a spiritual reality working through the Purusha, impressing itself on the Prakriti in the organization. So, Prakriti in and by itself, if we identify with it, even though the central Purusha is one of these beings, we may have little access to that central Purusha because we are completely under the, you know, movement of Prakriti. Identified with the movement of Prakriti at that level. However, Purusha can make itself more prominently, sort of manifest, impress itself on Prakriti in that level. And that's when we find some kind of extraordinary qualities of that particular level. If the psychic is behind it, then there is even some divine quality that seems to emerge at that level. Sri Aurobindo points out, for example, there is an ideal of beauty in the body or some kind of, you know, harmony of physical expression or skill through one's actions. Or if it is to be in the vital, there is an elevation and refinement of the feelings. There is a great deftness in the utilization of the will, skill in the use of the will. If it is in the mind, it is in great understandings, powers of intuition, etc. The power of the philosopher, the scientist, or that kind of, you know, utilization of the power of seeing and thinking. Now, then he points out that though this may happen due to the predominant impress of one of these beings, human being in a sense is not made up of just one of these beings. Human being is an integral being. Yet, because we have followed a certain trajectory of development, this idea of development, developmental psychology, as it is called, comes into place in the sense that there is a certain kind of a movement from physical to vital to mental. However, if there is not sufficient development at any particular level, that level is likely to be one of the, unorganized parts of one's existence. So Sri Aurobindo points out that this problem of the lack of integrality is a major problem that comes from the misunderstanding of the central being as one of these predominant Purushas. The Purusha, in a developmental sense, is given a certain priority but other parts of the being, as it were, remain unaddressed. So you see that, and we mentioned it out very beautifully in the paragraph we have just completed, where there is the sense, if you read between the lines, of how easy it is for the appearance of a well-governed life to fall into chaos if one just touches the wrong buttons. Man of knowledge, of wisdom, or of high thinking, nevertheless, often has very little kind of power in the vital and physical levels. Either as little skill in the physical activities, or vital life is something that they can't regulate properly, so that they fall prey to these kinds of, you know, sort of subconscious actions or activities behind the veil of the mental control. Now, similarly, on the other hand, when you find the vital life, we find that the person may have some power of action, may be a great doer, a practical person, effective in life, but doesn't have much skill as far as physical activities are concerned, just a kind of a manager type, or doesn't have fine thinking. Thinking doesn't move beyond a certain practical spectrum of things. Again, similarly, of course, we know very well that those in whom the physical being is predominant may be great athletes, acrobats, beings of skill, craftsmen, but may lack the other two. So in each case, we find that there is a certain appearance of, you know, organization which allows us to get the feeling of a ordered life of a certain kind. But just behind the surface, this ordered life dissolves into some unordered chaos. As soon as those parts which are not under the control of that central being become, you know, engaged. So this is where we were at this point. Now, Sri Aurobindo therefore hints at the fact that there is a severe problem of integrity in the normal human being. And in the history of humanity, whole human history, particularly when he's talking about mind, is pointing out how the whole history of human civilization has been an attempt of the mind to dominate the vital and the physical. That we have managed to create some sort of uneasy compromise, and our best phases, this compromise seems to be one which has yielded some high achievements of civilization. But if you study civilization, you will always find that it has been achieved through certain kinds of suppressions and dominations, certain oppressions and suppressions, which sooner or later have an effect of revolting and breaking down whatever harmony, precarious harmony has been achieved. So this is all pointing to the fact that somewhere there is lack of integrality. That the central being that we think of, even when we talk about things such as Swabhava and Swadharma, is seriously mistaken, because though we may start by looking at what is given to us, we have to replace the idea of the central being by the psychic being. Okay. Now, having gone this far, Sri Aurobindo is going to continue this train of thought in the next few paragraphs, where he look at the fact that the psychic may not merely be something which is very far behind these three purushas, but may also come close to them and start acting through them. Initially, our only access to the psychic being is through these beings, through the mental, vital, and physical being, through the central being as experienced by us. At first, that central being is operating in and by itself, hidden by its prakriti. Secondly, that prakriti's veil thins, and that particular purusha can act more strongly, but still then it hides the true central being, which is the psychic being. But in our opening to the psychic, it is possible that one or other of these other central beings, mental, vital, or physical, can become the access of the psychic. That is, the psychic being starts acting through one of these. How would we know that that is the case? That is what he is going to take up from this next paragraph on. From the expression of a high humanity, we move or we transition into a truly spiritual life. This is the transition of these purushas acting with the psychic power behind them, or with the prakriti hiding them, to another action in which they are much more in the front and the psychic is making itself known through them.
Devashishda?
Yeah.
So when we say the, so from this explanation, it seems that the central being is not really a thing in itself, right? It's more that if the mental being is more predominant, then you call that the central being. If the vital being is more predominant, you call that the central being. So central being does not have a separate reality, right? It's a word that we give to whatever is predominant. Is that correct?
Yeah, but you see, the way Sri Aurobindo is spelling this out, partly here, but he also elaborates it more in the letters. Central being has a relative degree of stability in each individual, in each life. So in a particular life, leave aside this idea of the triple transformation, etc., which is a far cry from most ordinary lives. In a normal human life, you find that a person lives with a certain central being active in their lives throughout that life. That is what gives a stamp of swabhava and swadharma to that particular life. This person, you know, apart from whatever pressures of circumstance that may create a profession, I'm not talking of profession, I'm talking about the natural expression of prakriti, which seems to have a certain bent. People have a bent towards the intellectual, or a bent towards the practical, or a bent towards, you know, whatever. That is something which is followed. It's part of the innate character, which in some sense, in an ordinary case, in a normal case, has a certain stability through a lifetime. Only if people really break boundaries, or if they are extremely versatile because the psychic being is already bringing into operation highly developed parts of other personalities in a person's life, then we can find what we call all-rounders who have got very high, you know, combination number of these purushas acting in one particular lifetime. But in general, a certain swabhava or swadharma seems to fix a person with relative, you know, stability through a certain life. Now, with yoga, what he's talking about, of course, is the whole process of bringing these things to the front. All these things start becoming more mutable. That's why it is important to start with acknowledging that there is a certain kind of central being which marks the existence in a certain life. It can be one's ally. But that can't be the end. That can only be a starting point for the bringing to the front of that activity, of the bringing to the front of the psychic being through that activity, and finally for the psychic to completely take over the entirety of the nature.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, Shyamdu.
A first condition of the soul's complete emergence is a direct contact in the surface being with the spiritual reality. Because it comes from that, the psychic element in us turns always towards whatever in phenomenal nature seems to belong to a higher reality and can be accepted as its sign and character. At first, it seeks this reality through the good, the true, the beautiful, through all that is pure and fine and high and noble. But although this touch through outer signs and characters can modify and prepare the nature, it cannot entirely or most inwardly and profoundly change it. For such an inmost change, the direct contact with the reality itself is indispensable, since nothing else can so deeply touch the foundations of our being and stir it or cast the nature by its stir into a ferment of transmutation. Mental representations, emotional and dynamic figures have their use and value. Truth, good and beauty are in themselves primary and potent figures of the reality, and even in their forms, as seen by the mind, as felt by the heart, as realized in life, can be lines of an ascent. But it is in a spiritual substance and being of them and of itself that which they represent has to come into our experience.
So this short paragraph is Sri Aurobindo's transition point. It is the way by which he is pointing out that from the normal human existence or operation of the central being to an operation in which the psychic can actually have some say in the life is this movement into what one might call the emergence of the spiritual man or the evolution of the spiritual man, as he's talked about it in the last chapter. That is that whatever it is that is giving us some higher kind of expression in the ordinary life has to be superseded for a direct action of the spiritual reality. Spiritual reality cannot hide behind certain forms of ideals. Ideals and idealisms belong to a certain kind of veiled reality of the spirit. They belong to the mental world. But even in the mental world itself, whether we talk about mental, vital, or physical world, spirit must make itself concretely, you know, real. There must be some kind of an opening to the direct action of spirit. This is the point he's saying. First condition of the soul's complete emergence is a direct contact in the surface being with the spiritual reality. The surface consciousness, this is a sign that the surface consciousness is no longer satisfied with symbols, ideals, and various kinds of higher manifestations or expressions of the mind in its sort of imitating forms of spirit. But there is a thirst directly for spirit which enters whatever part of the being they may be. That is the very first step, the sign of the emergence of psyche into the material life. Now, he's bringing in this small paragraph, the way he conducts the discussion, it is reminiscent of Plato, because these three ideals that he talks about, truth, good and beauty, are the three highest forms of the ideas, the Platonic ideas. Platonic ideas are like fundamental realities. They are not just ideas in the ideal sense. They become ideals for the mind. But the attractors, they are like magnets that pull human beings towards them, because we intuit some highest good coming out of a consciousness that represents itself through these three forms. Some people find it easier to move towards truth, some towards good, and some towards beauty. And in a way, these three may also relate to the three purushas. The one that moves towards truth is the mental purusha. The one, the thirst for truth is that of the mental purusha. The thirst for the good is the ardor of the vital purusha. And the thirst for beauty is the ardor of the physical purusha. So, these can remain ideals for the mind. And they can be expressed in a variety of ways, in a variety of people's minds, either through philosophy, through science, the truth, the thirst for truth can seem to satisfy itself through justice and through various kinds of ethical concerns, the thirst for goodness can satisfy itself, and through art and, you know, various kinds of pursuits of harmony and things of that nature, thirst for beauty may try to satisfy itself. But these, you know, seekings cannot fully, you know, encompass or give evidence to the life of the soul until in each of these seekings, the concrete sense of a reality that has this attribute, that is all-encompassing, is the source and origin of everything, is intuited. If that sense comes, that is what I am looking for. That's why he uses that like tat, like the Upanishadic tat with the capital T, the unnameable, yet only reality there is. See, that is what must become intuited by some part of the seeking itself, so that one feels whatever form it may take, it is the form of that. See, this is how he's presenting it over here. That's the very important transition from idealism to spirituality. Truth, good, and beauty are in themselves primary and portrayals of the reality, and even in their forms as seen by the mind, as felt by the heart, as realized in the life, can be signs of ascent. But it is in spiritual substance and being of them and of itself, that is, apart from its forms, in its own reality, that which they represent has to come into our experience. This is the transition. The thing is that this is a very subtle and invisible transition that takes place in those who thirst for spirit in whatever way, even when they don't realize it. It is this that overcomes that profound gulf which causes people to wonder about the existence or non-existence of spirit or God. The whole idea of atheism has its place so long as this particular concrete intuition of the spiritual substance of our ideal is not valid to our surface consciousness. Once it starts being experienced, even without our being conscious of it, an automatic aspiration rises for it. The start of that aspiration is the change of faith that is necessary so as to begin the spiritual life.
So, Devashishtha, this initial contact, is that something that he expects happens by accident, happens by some past build-up, or is it by conscious effort?
Now, it can happen by any of these that you have mentioned, but the very fact that he's writing about it means that he's not fully giving the sort of, you know, origin of these this contact to accident. See, that neither by purely by accident, nor purely due to past life development, etc. But that it is consciously possible to open oneself to this. This is the point he's making. That in fact we need to make this distinction. That's basically what he's telling us. To the extent that we can open ourselves to it, this possibility becomes a reality. That, yeah, at first it may remain an ideal, but from an ideal for it to become something in which a concrete experience of that which puts itself forth in these ideals can be itself an ideal, that is a sign of the emergence of the psychic being. So to open oneself to that possibility, is it possible? Just to open oneself to that possibility is an invitation for that process to take place. Now, I want to, you know, sort of complete thought about the Platonic idea in that paragraph, which is also very interesting, because Plato, of course, you know, is very far back in time, and just like things like the Upanishads, of course, Plato is not that far back, but still, Plato comes to us from close to the time of the Buddha, and in his whatever writings remain to us, there are two things that come very clearly. One is the sense of these ideals, which are independent realities that have a life of their own. They are not just truth, good and beauty, are not just mental conceptions that, you know, drive us towards their achievement because they are hardwired into a human being in some way. But they are independent realities that are drawing nature towards their manifestation. Now, the other important thing is what he calls the notion of the daemon, okay, which is sometimes spelled D-A-E-M-O-N and sometimes D-A-I-M-O-N. And Sri Aurobindo has pointed out that the Platonic daemon is nothing else than the psychic being. So it is this daemon which is in the cave of the heart, which ultimately is that which can bring us into contact with the concrete sense of these ideals. These ideals will remain mental ideals until and unless the daemon comes to the front. There is that sense is also there in Plato. So it's very interesting. In a way, this short paragraph, in my understanding at least, bears a certain echo. Sri Aurobindo is perhaps drawing on his own sort of, you know, erudition on Plato in this particular paragraph. Because indeed it is the coming to the front of the daemon, which he says has to be practically attempted by opening oneself to that daemon. One has to develop a psychic intuition, in other words, to use the Aurobindonian terminology, through one's daily practice to come into contact with that, and then that brings this possibility of a more concrete sense of the ideas, of the truth of the idea.
Can you please tell that where Sri Aurobindo says that Platonic daemon is nothing but psychic being?
I'm not sure whether he says it in some of his books, but definitely it's there in the letters. If you maybe Google the word daemon, I think he spells it D-A-E-M-O-N, but essentially he talks about the Platonic daemon as the psychic being which one has to open oneself to, and he gives the example of Plato himself, who apparently trusted this daemon even to the extent of the roads that he would take. Sri Aurobindo gives an example of how he records the fact that he took the wrong road and the wrong kind of thing happened. And he makes the connection and says that is the way in which the openness to the psychic has to be followed. So it's in his letters. If you, you know, maybe look for Plato or Daemon, you'll find this letter.
Devashish, so when we read Sri Aurobindo and we read about the psychic being, we never think of it, I mean, as an abstract concept, right? We know it as a real substance which can be experienced by yoga. But is that really the case of people reading Plato as well? Do we really understand a daemon as a practical concept rather than as an abstract, as an abstraction of certain qualities?
Yeah, I mean, very possibly most people think of it as an abstraction of qualities, just as very possibly most people think of these Platonic ideas as just ideals, mental ideals. Sri Aurobindo is pointing this out, perhaps in a similar vein as he has reinterpreted things like Upanishads and Veda, while most people think other things about the Upanishads and Veda. So it is also possible that this is Sri Aurobindo's excavation of the truth of these things. But of course, the history of Western philosophy also leads to reinterpretations of Plato through the mystical vein. Plato becomes, in a way, like the kind of founding figure of the whole of Western philosophy. You know, Whitehead had a comment where he said, the whole of Western philosophy may be thought of as a series of footnotes to Plato. So, from that point of view, I mean, and this statement is also used by somebody else, I think by, I'm trying to remember who, somebody else in recent times, you know, one of these integral thinkers, I don't think it's Ken Wilber, but it may have been Ken Wilber or one of them, has quoted this and gone on to say, in a similar vein, the future may look at Sri Aurobindo and say that all integral thought is nothing but footnotes to Sri Aurobindo. So, you know, he opens up an entire kind of range of thinking, which includes the mystical. So, what are called the Neoplatonists, of whom Plotinus is one of the main thinkers, take that completely mystical view of all of Plato's writings. That's where this whole idea of soul and these more Upanishadic kind of ideas enter into Plato's interpretation.
Yeah, thank you, Udayavashista. Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Jyoti, would you like to read?
Just a second, I was just searching about this plateau, and it came out with one result, in stray thoughts, the harmony of virtue, volume 3. And saying that Plato, who whispered that it was Meredith who taught me that the epigram is the soul of style. And Plato, who whispered that rhythm is its body, words are the texture of the flesh, and sentence is the system of hard matter that gives it consistency. The texture of the flesh may be coarse or delicate, and as you design, so you shall build. So just as Socrates was nothing without his daemon, so the artist is helpless if he has not his daemon at his elbow. And who is the artist's daemon? The artist's conscience.
This is a different one. I've actually never come across this one. This is also very interesting. Also, it pointedly uses the word Socratic daemon. Socrates is the one who must have taught it. And Plato has got a book called Socrates, because Socrates was Plato's teacher. So he has a book on Socrates in which this idea of the daemon is carried. But there is another entry on daemon in the letters somewhere. I'm sure of it because I've read it.
I thought we came across a daemon earlier in the Life Divine 2 once. And that's when you mentioned that it refers to the psychic being.
Correct. We came across that. In fact, you're right. Sri Aurobindo himself uses the term daemon earlier in the Life Divine. Quite right. But he doesn't reference Plato there. But that term is a coinage by Plato. Sri Aurobindo's usage itself is actually a reference to Platonic use of the term.
Yeah, that's what you mentioned. When the word daemon was used, I remember you told us that it was a reference to Plato's terminology.
Well, isn't it a Greek word?
No, in that context.
But in Greek, it must mean something, right?
Yeah, I don't know that it has any other meaning, but essentially, I don't think anybody, I mean, the usage, the only person that uses that term is Plato. He's the one who's referenced as the person using the term.
Mm-hmm. In technology, it is used as as the witness kind of thing.
Right, right.
I believe
like
it's the same
kind
concept,
of,
yeah.
Sort of a wakeful kind of process which is watching all the time for certain events to take place.
Mm-hmm. It's like the being behind the manifestation. Upholding it or supporting it.
Probably somebody would send a few more pictures.
No, it's possible that the original meaning in Greek meant something of a process or...
they must have also got it from Plato. They must have got it from Plato too. It's just another use of that particular...
Mm-hmm.
Another form of that particular usage. He's continuing the train of thought, and he's taking us essentially into in these coming paragraphs into a summary form of what he elaborates in the synthesis of yoga. That is that this psychic aspiration can manifest itself through whatever central being is presenting itself as the organizer of a person's life, and can turn that towards some concrete sense of the divine. That's why aspiration is always psychic in its origin. But it can act through any part of the nature. So in this case, it may make use of the mind. And when it does that, these mental ideals start developing a certain kind of concreteness of spiritual reality. There is the sense that an impersonal reality exists and that mind can come into contact with that. Whatever form it may have, it exceeds those forms. And so here he extends those ideals beyond truth, good and beauty to purity and bliss also. And of course there are other places in the very first chapter in which he has even other ideals, more ideals. So all these become ways by which the mind grows spiritual through the influence of the psychic. Growing spiritual is a way by which the inner mind substance transforms itself, psychicizes itself to that extent, but experiences through its own modality the concreteness of spirit. Mind experiences in a impersonal form. And so, rather than just ideals, these become impersonal spiritual experiences. So he says that leads to a transformation of the mind. But a transformation of the mind can have a partial effect on the rest of the being. Just as in the other cases, the central being can only have a partial effect on the rest of the being. Here even a spiritual transformation of the mind, making it pure, tranquil and wide, as he's saying, pure, large, tranquil and impersonal, brings about a tranquilizing influences on parts of life, but many parts of the life, particularly in the creative parts, the parts that are seeking new life energies, they will not necessarily be touched by this particular experience. So that's the reason why he will push forward and in these next few paragraphs make the case for what he does in the synthesis of yoga. That is, whatever the psychic being finds it more useful to express itself through, approach the divine to that in a kind of way in which that becomes concrete to us in experience. But tie in, bring in the others as well, you see. Other purushas must also be brought into that same concrete endeavor, even if they come in as followers of the pure sadhana.
Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Kirka, you want to read? Keka, you want to read it? Hmm. Monica, do you want to read?
Okay. A high endeavor to the mind does not change this balance, for the tendency of the spiritualized mind is to go on upwards, and since above itself the mind loses its hold on forms, it is into a vast, formless and featureless impersonality that it enters. It becomes aware of the unchanging self, the sheer spirit, the pure bareness of an essential existence, the formless infinite and the nameless absolute. This culmination can be arrived at more directly by tending immediately beyond all forms and figures, beyond all ideas of good and evil, or true or false, or beautiful or unbeautiful, to that which exceeds all dualities, to the experience of a supreme oneness, infinity, eternity, or other ineffable sublimation of the mind's ultimate and extreme percept of self or spirit. A spiritualized consciousness is achieved and the life falls quiet. The body ceases to need and to clamor. The soul itself merges into the spiritual silence. But this transformation through the mind does not give us the integral transformation. The psychic transmutation is replaced by a spiritual change on the rare and high summits. But this is not the complete divine dynamization of nature.
So this is really a continuation of the thought that he introduces in the previous paragraph, that this leads to his own kind of realization of spirit, which is the mental purusha's realization of spirit. But the other part of the being, the other persons in us, remain unfulfilled and in some way not brought under the control or under the power of a spiritual experience. Now, this aspect is also dealt with in the Gita. And one of the key kind of concerns of the Gita, which lead to its own sense of synthesis or integration, has to do with the distinction that it makes, not so much between mental, vital and physical purushas, though it introduces these terms, but more between a bipartite division into akshara and chara purusha. Akshara purusha is that which does not change, which does not immutable, mutate in any form. Chara purusha is that which is changing in the movement of time. So the reason it brings up these is essentially to create a finer distinction between what Sankhya has introduced earlier as difference between Purusha and Prakriti. Overall difference between Purusha and Prakriti, leading to the idea of Purusha which must enter into the consciousness of spirit of Purusha, which must give us the freedom from the movements of Prakriti, so that Prakriti is put to sleep. This kind of an idea is evidently more related to what he is talking about here. It is mental purusha that finds this kind of an idea natural to it. But the Gita makes a finer distinction by pointing out that this kind of a realization belongs to the akshara purusha. But purusha has another or other aspect which has to do with its existence within the mutating reality of time. And that in a sense, it is drawn by that reality to change itself. The changing part of the purusha is ultimately the psychic purusha, the psychic personality. The personality which is changing. That behind it is not changing, course. But this mutating part is necessary, because only thereby can a certain kind of soul nature develop, which can have power over cosmic nature, over universal nature. So, Shara Purusha has to be brought into the spiritual experience in a different way. It does not suffice for it if there is only a certain action in the mental Purusha leading to an impersonal realization of this vastness and freedom of the spirit. There must also be the other Purushas that have their own realizations of the same spirit for an integral approach in which the central being is replaced by the psychic being. Psychic being may start by its impression on one of these Purushas, but the other Purushas must be brought in if the psychic being can have its handle in its fullness as an integrating principle.
Top, no, click on that. Yeah. Yeah.
Vrishtha, here he uses the word transmutation and transformation interchangeably, right?
Okay, I'm trying to see where it is.
The last sentence.
Okay, the psychic transmutation is replaced by spiritual change and the rare and high. Yeah. I would say he's using interchangeably as transformation.
So when he says the psychic transmutation is replaced by a spiritual change on the rare and high summit, he means that this, the mind reaching out is actually the spiritual change, which is not the psychic transmutation.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And this merely the spiritual change is not the complete divine dynamization of nature.
Correct, yeah.
Whereas the psychic transmutation would have been.
Yeah, at least it would be an integral dynamization. Not, that would also not be the complete divine dynamization of nature, but it would be an integral kind of transmutation of a certain degree.
So a lot of Indian traditional spirituality or yogas like Vedanta and Advaita, they all actually follow this, right? The mind's transformation.
Yeah.
I found one more line. It's interesting. So I'm thinking of mentioning. In Letters of Yoga, the rebirth, he's saying that one like Shelley or like Plato, for instance, could be said to have a developed mental being centered around the psychic. Of the vital, the same can hardly be said. Napoleon had a strong vital, but not one organized around the psychic being.
That's very interesting. Yeah, very. It's much more difficult. No, here he will point out, yeah, see the vital, particularly the vital will, as the vital Purusha predominantly having a psychic behind it, has been very difficult to organize, I feel, as he is pointing out over there. Quite interesting, yeah. He'll point out here that vital lends itself to the emotions, so you have the saints and the bhaktas, etc. That is the next paragraph. But then he points out about the will, and with the will it is much more difficult. And he says that the will can burst if the mind and the emotions can lend themselves to the psychic. Then the will can be brought in as a kind of a, you know, subsidiary element and made into this thing. But generally speaking, you know, it's very difficult to find people who have a very powerful vital, a psychic acting through a powerful vital.
So there aren't any, you know, so to say, examples of personalities that have really managed to organize their vital will around the psychic, is it?
No, not that there aren't, there probably are, but it's not so easy to find. I mean, now, for example, you know, like, I can think about some examples that are given out of, say, the Japanese culture. Like, you know, there was in the samurai culture, there are examples of this kind of highly spiritual beings who, you know, are fighters. Mm-hmm. So there is one particular person like that who is very well known. His name is Miyamoto Musashi. I think we saw his paintings in that exhibition.
Yes.
Miyamoto Musashi, who lived at
the Five Rings, yes.
Yeah, now he was also a great artist. Now, his life and the general legend around him, at least, makes him out to be an incredibly powerful fighter who was at the same time highly spiritual. And, you know, his spirituality was not something which was in the mind, but it was really in the action, in the power of, you know, as he said, the union of the brush and the sword. You know, he saw both of them as equally expressive of spiritual reality. And even his passing is really described in a very powerful spiritual way. So there may be people like that, to some extent, that there must be in that kind of a case a powerful psychic impression on the vital Purusha, which is acting, you know, on the vital prakriti, or through the vital prakriti.
So we can also say artists like Leonardo, they had some psychic, and who is that, Mozart, they might have had some psychic qualities because they were such superlative artists.
Yeah, but I think what Rika was reading out, see, in art, certainly the vital is involved. But just like with the bhakta, so many bhaktas are there, there also the vital is involved, as you point out. In fact, probably the more predominant, you know, expression of spirituality is through saints and bhaktas, even more than these, you know, people of the mind reaching some impersonal, you know, phase. But I think by the vital proper has to involve the dynamic will. And, you know, men of action are the ones who, you know, whether they are statesmen or warriors or administrators or politicians, that's the field where they are really in lacking. You know, it's much more difficult to find those kind of examples. Or businessmen, for that matter.
Mm.
In the Mahabharata, Arjuna would be considered such a person. Or maybe Yudhishthira to some extent. But Yudhishthira has got very serious laws. And, you know, maybe Arjuna, you know. But still, I mean, when you say these are ideals of the Kshatriya that existed in ancient times in India.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might have lent themselves to the development of the psychic through the vital Purusha in action or in governance or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or Janaka, the king, for example. But to us, these are more mythical figures than historical figures. That's why Sri Aurobindo is drawing on modern history, talking about people like Napoleon in comparison to other figures who are also of our times.
Keka, you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
A second approach made by the soul to the direct contact. This is through the heart. This is its own more close and rapid way because its occult seat is there. Just behind, in the heart center, in close contact with the emotional being in us. It is consequently through the emotions that it can act best at the beginning with its native power, with its living force of concrete experience. It is through a love and adoration of the all beautiful and all blissful, the all good, the true, the spiritual reality of love, that the approach is made. The aesthetic and emotional parts join together to offer the soul, the life, the whole nature to that which they worship. This approach through adoration can get its full power and impetus only when the mind goes beyond impersonality. When the mind goes beyond impersonality to the awareness of a supreme personal being, then all becomes intense, vivid, concrete. The heart's emotion, feeling, spiritualized sense reach their absolute. An entire self-giving becomes possible, imperative. The nascent spiritual man makes his appearance in the emotional nature as the devotee, the bhakta. If in addition he becomes directly aware of his soul and its dictates, unites his emotional with his psychic personality, and changes his life and vital parts by purity, God ecstasy, the love of God, and men and all creatures, into a thing of spiritual beauty, full of divine light and good, he develops into the saint and reaches the highest inner experience and most considerable change of nature proper to this way of approach to the divine being. But for the purpose of an integral transformation, this too is not enough. There must be a transmutation of the thinking mind and all the vital and physical parts of consciousness in their own character.
So, as you were pointing out, each of these has got its own door through which the psychic can approach. And as he points out here, this is the easiest, perhaps, psychic because its own seed is right behind the emotional being. But that does not mean that the emotional being is the psychic being. Also, as he points out over there, that this particular being has an access to the divine which it must take to be personal. So this is, you know, the way by which the one infinite reality can make itself approachable to different aspects of consciousness in different ways. To mental consciousness, it is an impersonal consciousness. To the consciousness of the heart, of the emotional being, it is a personal consciousness. It is a personal being, such person. So, in that approach, there is a certain kind of fulfillment, and the heart is that through which the psychic gets a concrete experience of the divine person. But again, he ends with the same sort of lacuna, saying that this is one way of approaching or of receiving the divine, but it is not the integral way. These approaches that he's pointing out also relate to something else that Sri Aurobindo has talked about here and elsewhere, particularly with regard to his own personal aspiration, which is that these very differences in God experience or in spiritual experience point to the fact that these are a variety of ways of experiencing the same reality by limited means. These are man's approaches to the divine, man's knowledge of the divine, not the divine's knowledge of himself. This becomes a key distinction with which Sri Aurobindo, one may say, opens up his own questioning. You know, there is a sense that every great philosopher, even if we look at them as, I'm not talking about philosophy just as a mental pursuit, I'm talking about it as an existential pursuit, begins with some one major question which they pursue in its great ramifications. I would say Sri Aurobindo's major question is this very one. How can we know God not as man knows God, but as God knows himself? And all these are ways by which we can be sure that these are not the ways by which God knows himself. These are two different ways by which God may be known. We can be sure that each of them is a limited approach to the divine knowledge, not God's awareness of himself.
Should we read the next paragraph? I can read it.
Sure.
This larger change can be partly attained by adding to the experiences of the heart a consecration of the pragmatic will, which must succeed in carrying with it, for otherwise it cannot be effective, the adhesion of the dynamic vital part, which supports the mental dynamics and is our first instrument of outer action. This consecration of the will in works proceeds by a gradual elimination of the ego will and its motive power of desire. The ego subjects itself to some higher law and finally effaces itself, seems not to exist, or exists only to serve a higher power or a higher truth, or to offer its will and acts to the divine being as an instrument. The law of being and action, or the light of truth which then guides the seeker, may be a clarity or power or principle which he perceives on the highest height of which his mind is capable. Or it may be a truth of the divine will which he feels present and working within him, or guiding him by a light or a voice or a force or a divine person or presence. In the end, by this way, one arrives at a consciousness in which one feels the force or presence acting within and moving or governing all the actions, and the personal will is entirely surrendered. Let me begin this sentence again. The law of being and action, or light of truth, which then guides the seeker, may be a clarity or power or principle which he perceives on the highest height of which his mind is capable. Or it may be a truth of the divine will which he feels present and working within him, or guiding him by a light or a voice or force or a divine person or presence. In the end, by this way, one arrives at a consciousness in which one feels the force or presence acting within and moving or governing all the actions, and the personal will is entirely surrendered or identified with that greater truth will, truth power, or truth presence. A combination of all these three approaches, the approach of the mind, the approach of the will, the approach of the heart, creates a spiritual or psychic condition of the surface being and nature in which there is a larger and a more complex openness to the psychic light within us and to the spiritual self or the Ishwara, to the reality now felt above and enveloping and penetrating us. In the nature there is a more powerful and many-sided change, a spiritual building and self-creation, the appearance of a composite perfection of the saint, the selfless worker, and the man of spiritual knowledge.
So this is the synthesis of yoga. You can see that here he starts with talking about the realization possible to the mind, but in all these cases it is the psychic that is behind, goading it towards its spiritual realization. Or there may be a different kind of realization possible to the emotional being. And then finally, he says that the dynamic parts of the will, the active parts of the vital, must be brought into this entire journey. And it can be done so by making a will selfless instrument, a kind of surrendered power, which is completely utilized or used by the divine being, divine will. So, as this proceeds or progresses, the sense of an integral being starts, of the divine as an integral being, starts growing in us. And it grows from two directions. One is from within and the other is from above. It's the sense that there is a being, a person behind all these various approaches of the different parts of the being, and that is that which is guiding us or leading us and acting through us. That central being is moving towards, or the acknowledgement of, we move towards the acknowledgement of the central being as the psychic being. And at the same time, there is also the sense that there is a integral being that is moving us from above, penetrating us as Ishwara and moving us from above. That is the Ishwara whose action or power, Shakti, is in all levels of is active in all levels of the being and felt to be one single power and presence. This particular paragraph is like the culmination of the synthesis of yoga, and really also what he calls the Karma Chatushtaya in the record of yoga, where there is the realization of Krishna and Kali as the dual powers that are actually seen in all things outside and within.
See, he uses the word self-creation. It is like the Swayambhu. Is it not?
I'm trying to see where you
said. Again, the last line.
Yes.
The last line. In the nature, there is a more powerful and many-sided change, spiritual building and self-creation.
Correct. Correct. The appearance of a more composite perfection of the saint, the selfless work and the... So this self-creation is really the creation of the fullness of the psychic personality. This is how the psychic personality is getting formed, as something which is, you know, to some extent natural, but self-creation because it is creating itself. And that self-creation is taking place due to the mutual action between these different parts of the being and the psychic being. That also leads to the integration of the inner being around the psychic being. The psychic transformation is ultimately a self-creation of that form. That a formation is taking place, that building or forming activity is done through this particular process, which is really a process of self-creation.
Does it mean self as in S capital creation?
See, when Sri Aurobindo uses the word self with a capital S, then he's talking about Atman or Purusha, usually.
Uh-huh.
There is a certain impersonal and universal quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Here he's using it with a small S, which I believe he's using from the viewpoint of the psychic being. There's three kinds of S's or four kinds of S's. One is self with a capital S, which is Atman or Purusha. One is the psychic being, the innermost self, as he calls it. One is, of course, the ego, which is on the surface. And one is the power of identification as a form of attention, which is what he calls jiva. So here it is between the jiva and the psychic being that this particular formation is taking place. So that's the yoga, power of yoga is the mobilization of the power of attention to bring the psychic being, to let its designs unfold properly or in a more concentrated way.
Mm-hmm.
So, from that point of view, that is the self that he's talking about here. Not so much the Atman, self is a capital S.
And again, the last part when he says about these three things, the perfection of the saint, the selfless worker, and the man of spiritual knowledge, is he trying to say about the good, the saint, the beauty
the good,
and the
good, the true, and the beautiful?
Yeah.
Roughly, but I think it actually, it doesn't really fit that well. Those three ideas, I think he brings them up only in that particular paragraph.
Mm.
But those three ideas are exceeded by a number of other ideas.
Yeah.
Then in the very next paragraph, he introduces some other ideas as well.
Okay, but these three don't fit the three yogas either, right? The yoga of Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, and
Dhyana
Yoga. Shall we end today here?